This is Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio. I'm Ashton Mara. Today on our show, headlines across the state depict the rough battles happening on the campaign trail. But outside of West Virginia, are the state's congressional races getting any attention? With a longstanding incumbent in jeopardy of losing his seat to a newcomer on the federal level, a congressional seat up for grabs in a wide open race, and a guaranteed first ever female senator for the state, it's safe to say this election is a big one. Coming up, Ken Rudin, host of NPR's Political Junkie, puts it all into perspective. We'll talk congressional races here in West Virginia and why the rest of the country is watching. Also on our show, a study by the Pew Research Center that says political ideologies aren't as simple as red and blue, but come in every shade in between. And a profile of Libertarian candidate Davy Jones, today on Viewpoint. Stay with us. You're listening to Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio. I'm Ashton Mara. We're less than 60 days out from Election Day and right in the thick of campaign season. The race for congressional seats is in the spotlight here in the state, but how do we fare from a national perspective? Joining us this morning to help us understand the country's view of West Virginia's races, host of NPR's Political Junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, thanks for being with us today.
Good morning. I'm thrilled to be here.
Before we get to our first question, I'd like to start by reminding our listeners that you can send in your questions this morning for Ken by using the hashtag ViewpointWV or by calling us at 304-556-4994. Ken, before we get into talking about the specific races, I want to ask a little more generally. You know, we see an article in Politico or the Washington Post about politics in West Virginia every once in a while, but just how important are the state's races this year on the national scale? Are people watching to see what happens here?
Well, even though the Senate race doesn't look close, I mean, the Republicans have, as I said, a lead for a long, long time in this, in the race for Jay Rockefeller's Senate seat. Having said that, though, it's crucial if the Republicans are going to get a majority in the Senate, and they are very close to getting that. West Virginia has to go Republican way. And what's fascinating about this story, why it has so much national interest and national attention, is that Republicans have not won a Senate race in West Virginia since 1956. No state in the country has gone a longer time. And so while, of course, there are a lot of people who are excited about the fact that West Virginia will get its first female senator because two women are running against each other, the big news is that it very likely will go Republican for the Senate. And again, we're talking about a half a century or more since that's last happened.
How about the House races? Are people taking an interest in those as well?
They absolutely are because, you know, whenever we talked about how the South, well, I don't know what, how you describe West Virginia geographically, it's either the East or the South, different groups categorize it different ways. But when you think of West Virginia, while much of the region has gone Republican in recent years, certainly since Reagan, a lot of the House seats going Republican, West Virginia has basically stayed very loyal to its Democratic roots. And in the Nick Rahal seat in the 3rd District, I mean, that has gone Democratic forever. And of course, while control of the House is not thought to be in jeopardy for the Republicans in 2014, you still have the possibility of Rahal losing his House seat. And again, that is back to historical proportions because Republicans don't win in that district.
You know, Rahal's race also plays kind of a bigger piece for West Virginia because he's the longest serving right now. He's the longest serving member of the House that we have. Capito's leaving. McKinley beat Mollahan just a few years ago. And so Rahal is a ranking member on some pretty important committees, even though he's not in the Republican majority. Last week, Dr. Rob Rupp, who's one of our political analysts, called him the last of the blue dog Democrats in the state. Since Byrd, Mollahan, now Rockefeller are all out, him losing that seat means a pretty big loss for West Virginia as far as ranking Democrats in the House.
It would, and it certainly would make a big difference as far as seniority. Now, of course, being a senior Democrat in a Republican-controlled House, you know, that and 15 cents will get you a cup of coffee. It's not, you know, to be a Democrat in a Republican House, it looks like it's going to stay in GOP hands for at least until the end of the decade, 2020, maybe beyond, doesn't seem to help people like Rahal get what he wants. But it is historical. It is a stunner, the fact, I mean, I'm not sure if he loses. He could lose, but the point is, it's stunning to think that somebody in that region of the country, a Democrat in that region of the country, could lose. But that's what's happening to West Virginia. That's what's happening to the politics of coal. And, of course, with favorable district lines, the Republicans are looking at expanding their lead in districts like the 3rd in West Virginia.
And also what we're seeing in Ray Hall's race is that, you know, he didn't win by that big of a margin in 2010. I think it was something like 8 percentage points, definitely in single digits against his Republican candidate. So it's a tight race still.
It is. And I think he won by 12 points in 2010. But remember, Republicans were sweeping everywhere around the country in 2010. And that was the big Tea Party victory that year. But he won by 12 points in 2010. He won by 8 points in 2012. Both of them were big Republican years. 2012, we know how Barack Obama did in West Virginia. We know that Barack Obama lost 41% to a convicted extortionist in the Democratic primary. I mean, that's the depth of antipathy for Barack Obama in West Virginia. So the numbers have not been look good for Ray Hall. The fact that he's held on in two big Republican years like 2010, 2012 is testament to his seniority and all the stuff that he stood for. But this is a tough year, and you know, they're running against him. He's one of the five most vulnerable Democratic incumbents in the House this year.
In the second, the two big names are Democrat Nick Casey running against Republican Alex Mooney. How do you see that race playing out right now?
Well, I know the Republicans just put out a poll that had, of course, it was a Republican poll that has Mooney up by 12. The Democrats say, well, that may not really be the case. But this is more of a Republican-leaning seat. This is the one that Shelley Moore Capito has held since 2000. So she's been around for a while. It seems to be going in Republican hands. And of course, while Mooney is best known to be the Republican state chair of Maryland, not West Virginia, and West Virginia is not a state that usually welcomes outsiders to politics, the political leanings have changed in the district, I think helped by Capito's success. And my gut tells me that the Republicans keep that seat. It's probably going to be the most one of the most closely watched seats, but nothing is more closely watched than the Ray Hall seat, because if the Republicans could get that one, that's a real feather in the cap.
I do want to touch on the point that Mooney is seen as a little bit of an outsider. Now, he makes the point that he made it through the primary, so being an outsider is not an issue anymore. That's obsolete. But we've seen in the past, I mean, it took Jay Rockefeller plenty of time to get elected to office because he was seen as an outsider.
I still remember that. I mean, I remember him losing to Archmore for governor in 1972. I remember them seeing him as an outsider because he went to school outside of West Virginia. Of course, the thought of Jay Rockefeller not being in West Virginia now seems kind of almost comical. But back in the day, when he was Nelson Rockefeller's nephew, and he was an outsider, and of course he lost. But you know, he did have a successful career, winning the governorship. First, he was Secretary of State, and winning the governorship, and of course all the terms in the Senate. But even when he first ran for the Senate in 1984, I remember at the time I was working for ABC News. We were about to call the winner. I think, I don't know if it was John Racy or whoever it was. I think it was John Racy in 84. But Rockefeller almost lost that race, too. So when you think of all these decades of Democrats winning for the Senate in West Virginia, you think of it as an automatic vote. But sometimes, if you go behind the scenes, the races are very, very close. And Rockefeller certainly had his share of close races.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a second to remind listeners that you're listening to Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio. This morning, we're talking to Ken Rudin of NPR's Political Junkie. He's taking your questions on Twitter using the hashtag ViewpointWV or your calls at 304-556-4994. Ken, we have our first question from Twitter that says, how close does the West Virginia Senate polling get after all the messaging occurs, both positive and negative?
Well, you know, you could always ask a question in a certain way. You could always a lot of polling numbers depend on how the question is asked. But I have not seen Capito with anything less than a 15 to 20 point in some polls lead over Natalie Tennant. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why. A lot of it is about coal. A lot of it is about President Obama, even though Natalie Tennant is hardly a supporter of President Obama. She says, you know, she says she'll fight for West Virginia, not for President Obama's agenda in the Senate. But at the same time, you have somebody like Harry Reid, the Democratic Senate Majority Leader from Nevada, who once famously said that coal makes us sick, and Harry Reid's PAC has given $10,000 to Natalie Tennant. So it's hard for her to break, as hard as she tries, it's hard for her to break away from national Democrats like Reid, like Obama. And Capito seems to be doing everything right. Once upon a time, the knock on Capito was that she was not ideologically conservative enough for some Tea Party folks, but you know, any kind of challenge to her in the primary failed to materialize. The Republicans seem united, and you know, it seems like the Democrats, for most of the case, seems to be running on the defensive.
So 50-some days out, you're comfortable saying that you think that seats Capito's?
Well, you know, I always love these smarty pants people from Washington who make these predictions, and of course they haven't stepped foot in West Virginia or in these states in anywhere in their lives. I remember everybody in 2008 where we're clearly predicting the day of the election, the day of the primary, convinced that Barack Obama would defeat Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, and Clinton won that primary. So, you know, I mean, I always say that, look, if you can't accurately predict day of primaries, you have no business predicting what could happen 2 months down the line. But from all the numbers I've seen, from all the dynamics of the race since Jay Rockefeller announced his retirement, it's almost impossible to see Shelley Moore Capito losing the Senate race. But I'll tell you one thing, if she does lose the Senate race, you can kiss the Republican chances of winning control of the Senate goodbye, because West Virginia is one of those automatic GOP pickups that everybody's been considering all year long.
Interesting for a West Virginian like myself to hear you say that something hangs in the balance of what's going to happen during a West Virginia race.
Well, that's a very good point, because historically, I mean, we never paid attention to West Virginia Senate races. Look at Jennings Randolph, look at Robert Byrd, all those decades they had in the Senate, and they were always assured of winning. But things have changed, and part of it is, I mean, go back to even as recently as 1992 and 1996, when Bill Clinton was carrying West Virginia, and, you know, there was no question about that. But since 2000, things have changed. So it's not only Obama, because of George W. Bush carried West Virginia twice against Al Gore and then John Kerry. Things are changing, and the Democrats seem to be more on the defensive, because the National Democratic policy is about green gas and carbon emissions and things like that, and that does certainly affect West Virginia.
So I have another question about the third district, the third congressional district race. Does it matter that Jenkins switched parties from Democrat to Republican?
Well, it's always difficult to engender loyalty when you know you're a former. Actually, I think he was a former Republican who became a Democrat, and then became a former Democrat to become a Republican. There's always the argument about opportunism and things like that. And there's some people, he may have just alienated Republicans when he was a Democrat, but right now the Republican Party seems united. Again, this is an overwhelmingly Democratic registration district. And as I said, I mean, a Republican has never won the seat. If they're going to win it, probably this is now. Now's the time, because it's going to be the last time. Well, of course, in 2016, President Obama will be president as well. But, I mean, the Republicans have the advantage of running against Obama. They have running, you know, they will still run against the war on coal, even though, in fairness, Ray Hall has been a staunch supporter of coal through most of his 38 years in Congress. I mean, he's worked for mine safety. He's been all the right, done all the right things, said all the right things. But of course, he is running into a headwind of this anti-Obama sentiment, and this also this argument that the Democrats are supporting this war on coal. So he's almost frustrated by what the national Democratic policies have been.
You know, Ken, I think out of fairness, I have to ask you about the first congressional district race, where Democratic Auditor Glenn Gaynor is running against Republican incumbent and Congressman David McKinley. Do we expect anything out of that race?
I don't. I haven't been paying much attention to that. But then again, that's another one of those races, districts where, you know, I mean, I think, if memory serves, that the Republicans did well during the Reagan years. They got seats every now and then, but this was Alan Monahan's seat for the longest time. He was targeted for the longest time, and I think until his ethics problems got untenable. I mean, he could have been in Congress forever too, but David McKinley won that seat in 2010. When he won re-election in 2012, that wasn't close at all. So I mean, if you're looking at a national look at some House seats that could fall, could topple, West Virginia's first is not one of them.
Are we not hearing anything about that race because the matchup isn't that close? Or are we not hearing anything about that race because it's not in coal country?
Well, that's interesting, too. I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, coal is king when you consider the politics of what's going on in 2014 in West Virginia, and actually the last several years in West Virginia. It's not only that. I mean, even though the fact that it's not in coal country, it's still McKinley's not been on anybody's hit list. He doesn't look vulnerable at all. Perhaps if they were a Republican president and things were going really, really poorly, perhaps people would pay attention to it. But coal or not coal, right now that's not on anybody's radar screen.
I want to take a second to remind our listeners that you're listening to Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio. We're talking to Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, and he's taking your questions on Twitter using the hashtag ViewpointWV or taking your calls, 304-556-4994. We've been talking about it all morning just a little bit, but let's directly address this issue of coal. Obviously, in West Virginia, races are focused on President Obama's war on coal. The Republicans are attacking him for it. Democrats are constantly working to separate themselves from the president. Is coal making a major play in any other national elections like it is in West Virginia?
Well, the closest coming to is in Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell, he's the Republican minority leader in the Senate, hoping to become the majority leader. That's probably the only other place where coal is being a big, big issue. Other states like Ohio or Virginia or other coal-producing states, coal does not play the political doesn't have the political muscle it has in these two states. But Kentucky is like that, too. And it's also interesting, too, because like West Virginia, Kentucky also went for Bill Clinton in 1992 and 1996. And then things have changed. Things seem to change in 2000 with the Democrats being more aggressive on environmental concerns and Republicans being more defenders of coal. And just as with Natalie Tennant in West Virginia, Alison Lundgren Grimes, who's the Secretary of State in Kentucky, who is also campaigning against President Obama's so-called, I mean, we keep saying war on coal, but it is a political so-called issue, and she's trying to get traction, saying that the issue should not be President Obama, it should not be my connection to President Obama, it should be Mitch McConnell's 30 years in the Senate and whether that's been beneficial to the state or not. But Mitch McConnell is very adroit. He's a very savvy campaigner. He knows that Obama's numbers are dreadful in Kentucky, probably not as bad as West Virginia, but they're pretty bad. And so while people are not madly in love with Mitch McConnell, he is effectively running against Barack Obama in the face of Alison Lundgren Grimes, saying a vote for her is a vote for the president's extreme environmental agenda. So if anything, Kentucky and West Virginia seems to be very, very closely aligned. The only difference is that West Virginia has been a historic Democratic Senate seat, and the Republicans in West Virginia and Kentucky have held that seat since 1985.
Right. I think that's interesting to point out how similar those two races are. Two female Democrat Secretary of States running against two strong Republicans in Congress. And this issue of the Republican running against President Obama and the Democrat running against their candidate. They're taking such similar paths.
And not only that, even more fascinating to me is that both candidates, both Democratic candidates, Tennant in West Virginia and Grimes in Kentucky, have benefited or at least had visits from Elizabeth Warren, the very liberal, the very progressive senator from Massachusetts, who is on the left, in the left wing of the Democratic primary, Democratic caucus, Democratic Party there. And the fact is, Elizabeth Warren supports the president's views on the environment, supports the so-called war on coal. But her argument in West Virginia, as it is in Kentucky is that it's more than just coal. It's about economic inequality. She speaks the economic populism message that Democrats have used very effectively in Kentucky and West Virginia for so many years. So I just think it's interesting that somebody who is clearly to the left of the Democrats spectrum in culturally conservative states like Kentucky and West Virginia, and yet both Democratic candidates, both female Democratic candidates, have invited Elizabeth Warren down there to campaign for them.
So you think even in Natalie Tennant's push to separate herself from the president, having someone like Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts come visit the state and campaign with her, that doesn't hurt her race?
I don't know if it helps. Certainly, it could rally the base. I mean, there is still tremendous pockets of poverty in West Virginia that are not necessarily about coal. That, I mean, if you think of Ray Hall's district, there's been extreme poverty in that district for forever, and yet they've never taken their ire out. The voters have never taken their ire out on Ray Hall. So, I mean, it's been there, and I think that Elizabeth Warren and those progressive populist people who just talk about that kind of the rhetoric of economic fairness and economic opportunity and populism like that could benefit, it could help the base, it could bring out female voters. If we can talk about the Republicans talking about the war on coal, Democrats keep talking about the Republican war on women, and having Elizabeth Warren campaign for Natalie Tennant as well as Alison Grimes in Kentucky can bring out more women to the polls in November. But still, I still see this as more of an ideological district election, more so than a gender-related election. And so maybe she can bring out some more women, but ultimately I think the ideology wins out overall in both states.
Elizabeth Warren, the Democrat coming to West Virginia to campaign. The big names on the Republican side we've seen visits this year from former vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan, former presidential candidate Mitt Romney this week, Karl Rove, a former Bush advisor, campaigned in the state. Significant names in the Republican Party to be here in West Virginia?
Well, yes, only because, they know the race is very important. Two, they're convinced that Capito wins, so they don't hurt their standing in the party by campaigning here. But ultimately, I really don't think endorsements mean that much. I think whether it's a newspaper endorsement or endorsement by another a candidate, I just don't think it's so transferable. I mean, I remember, Ronald Reagan campaigning in West Virginia, and he was popular in West Virginia, but he would campaign for Senate candidates to no avail. I just think that it's not transferable. But I think the fact that you're having national political figures come up in the West Virginia just shows how significant this Senate race is. I mean, we've seen close Senate races in the past in West Virginia. We saw it in 84. We kind of saw it in 78 when Archmore ran against not Robert Byrd, but Jennings Randolph. I mean, sometimes they are close, but ultimately this is the first time that the Republicans could sit back and just say, wow, we're going to win this one. And this is, this is more than a half century in the making.
So interesting that you don't think these endorsements really are going to make that much of a difference, but we'll hear a piece coming up in the show from the Pew Research Center that says these midterm races are dependent. Winning that race is dependent on inciting the base. You're not going to get those voters in the middle to come out and vote. You have to drum up that base support on either side. So is that what they're accomplishing? They're drumming up the base by bringing in these national big names?
That's certainly what the purpose of Elizabeth Warren's visit to West Virginia, because I think Democrats are more on the defensive, more gloomy about their prospects. And so why not bring up a face who is an exciting face? I mean, whatever section of the country you're talking about, Elizabeth Warren is new. And when you think of the inevitability of Hillary Clinton in 2016 as the presidential candidate, well, people say, well, except she's kind of aggressive on foreign policy. As a Democrat, is this what I want after years of Iraq and Afghanistan? She's very close to Wall Street. I mean, we're bashing Shelley Capito for being a pawn, a tool of Wall Street. And here we have Hillary Clinton as a likely Democratic nominee who, if anything, is very, very close to Wall Street. So Tennant could rally the base that way. As far as Karl Rove, I never had a sense he had much of a constituency. Certainly he has a checkbook that's very important, as do the Koch brothers, and they're all for Capito. Paul Ryan, I don't think in so many races around the country, Senate races around the country, even in Kansas, they're running against Harry Reid. I'm not convinced that voters in Kansas know who Harry Reid is, and I'm not convinced voters in West Virginia will be pulled one way or the other because Paul Ryan is in the state to campaign for the Republican.
So, Ken, we have just about a minute left in this in our time, and I want to ask, outside of the state, what races should West Virginians be paying attention to, briefly?
Well, again, if Mitch McConnell is going to be the leader, and of course, if he's one of the champions on the war on coal, I mean, you want to watch that Kentucky race because that's very, very close. But there are several seats in Louisiana, in North Carolina, in Arkansas, in Alaska. These are Democratic incumbents in Mitt Romney red states that President Obama lost. If the Republican Party is going to win control in the Senate, they've got to win in these states. And if they do, then Shelley Moore Capito is one of the few people who go from a majority, a Republican majority in the House, to a Republican majority in the Senate. And, of course, that gives you more power and more influence.
Well, Ken Rudin, host of NPR's Political Junkie, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate your time.
Ashton, it was a lot of fun.
Interesting conversation.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio. I'm Ashton Mara.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by AARP, providing real possibilities to its nearly 300,000 members in West Virginia. On Facebook at AARP West Virginia or online at aarp.org/WV.
Are you a liberal or a conservative? When it comes to politics, Americans can often feel like the answer is black or white, or rather red or blue. But the Pew Research Center is trying to change that notion with a quiz that asks, where do you fit in the political typology spectrum? Although it starts with a quiz that places you into one of eight typologies, the Pew Research Center is using its results to prove that political values in this country come in many shades and hues. Earlier, I sat down with Jocelyn Kiley, an associate director of research with the Pew Center, who explains the process behind the quiz and what they're learning from it. Let's start with the quiz itself. What were you all trying to accomplish?
So the quiz is based on a series of questions that we ask our survey respondents. And what we do is we ask 23 questions about political values on everything from attitudes about the social safety net to the size of government to immigration, environment. And we use that data to see if groups emerge that are based on political values. And then we group people together. And in the report, we detail the types of groups that we see. And then in a quiz, we ask you or your listeners to take the quiz and see where they end up on the political spectrum.
So can we talk about the process? How did you all come up with the questions that were included in the quiz?
Well, many of these questions are part of a long-standing set of questions that we at the Pew Research Center have been asking going back into the 1990s. And so we've been using those questions to do this sort of work since 1994 and even before then, and so that we can look at political attitudes over time. But what we're looking for are questions that really span the set of political values that are part of American politics today that aren't specifically about policy issues. We're not asking in the quiz about your position on healthcare, for instance. We're asking about underlying political values that are associated with policy issues today.
So then at the end of this quiz, you're categorized into one of eight eight typologies that Pew has come up with. So can you explain how those eight groups differ from the plain liberal and conservative that the average American might think of?
Sure. Well, we have a tendency to see the world in terms of red and blue, Republican, Democrat, liberal, and conservative. And what we try to do here by asking about political values and using a statistical process, cluster analysis, to see how those values fall together is to look at whether, in fact, the world is more complicated. We all know people who have conservative values in one area. They might be they might favor small government, but also be liberal on some issues. For instance, they might be supportive of gay marriage. And those don't fit very neatly on a single spectrum, a liberal-conservative spectrum. And so what the typology quiz lets you do is state those preferences and see how you fall out. And one of the things that we find in these groups is that there's a lot of diversity in the middle. So when people talk about the middle of the American public, or sometimes people talk about independence instead of just talking about the middle of the American public, you can see that while there are a lot of people in the middle, that the people in that middle part of the political spectrum, they don't all agree. Some of them might be, you know, conservative, as I say, on something like foreign policy, or they may take an activist position on foreign policy coupled with a particular support for social safety net programs, where somebody else might take a more isolationist view of foreign policy coupled with a lack of support for social safety net programs. And those people in traditional political research might end up in the same middle. And we can see that they're just as diverse as looking at conventional differences between liberals and conservatives.
So of the 10,000 people that you all surveyed, did you find at the end that the American public is spread evenly across all eight of these groups within the spectrum? Or does it lean more one way or the other?
Well, one of the things that this process does, the statistical process does, is it sort of looks for groups that are roughly the same size. So we're not going to find a tremendous amount of variation between the size of one group and another, though they're not perfectly the same size. But one of the things that we do find is that the American public might be somewhat evenly spread across these particular groups, but that when you look at the people who are particularly politically engaged, you see a concentration among certain kinds of groups. So for instance, while, you know, only 12% of the general public are in the group that we call steadfast conservatives, who are pretty across the board conservative in a lot of positions, that group accounts for about 19% of politically engaged people. And the other conservative group, business conservatives, account for 10% of the public and about 17% of the politically engaged. So those groups are, you know, overrepresented to their relative to their overall size in the politically engaged. And the same is true among the most liberal group, solid liberals, 15% of the general public, 21% of the politically engaged. So some of the groups that are in the middle that are cross-pressured ideologically are less likely to be politically engaged than some of those groups on the right and on the left.
When you say politically engaged, as opposed to just members of the general public, can you explain how Pew differentiates between the two?
Sure. Well, the measure we use in this report is looking at people who are registered to vote, but beyond just being registered to vote, they also follow public affairs and they also vote fairly regularly. So what we're trying to do here is really look at trying to understand how sometimes people critique that, you know, it looks like people who participate in politics don't quite look like the general public. They might be more staunchly liberal or staunchly conservative. And in fact, this research and other research that we've done suggests that that's the case. The people who are the most ideologically consistent are the most likely to participate in politics.
So of these eight groups, there are two that I'm kind of particularly interested in, the young outsiders and the next generation left. Can you explain to me what those two categories are, kind of what those stand for?
Sure. So I'll start with the next generation left. This is a group that is, as its name might signal, left in its leaning. It's a fairly consistently Democratic voting group. It's one of the younger groups in our political typology. Actually, I think it might be the youngest of all of the groups. Very liberal on social issues, much like the solid liberal group. But they're a little bit less liberal when it comes to issues like the social safety net. So while they do vote consistently Democratic in some ways and on measures of what we call individualism, which is a kind of measure of whether you can do things on your own, it's hard work leads to success, they score higher than their liberal counterparts. The Young Outsiders are a really interesting group and new to our typology this year. They have a little bit of a Republican lean, but they are not consistently Republican by any stretch. They're very much in a lot of ways up for grabs. They're also a young group, and they have very conservative views when it comes to government size of the social safety net. So programs for the poor and needy tend not to be very supportive of those, look a lot like other conservative groups on those measures. But they are they're socially liberal. Or socially relatively liberal. They support gay marriage much more than other Republican groups. But they also have an environmental cast to them. So they're a very interesting group in a lot of ways. And one of the key things is they're not particularly happy with either Republicans or Democrats. And there's a lot to suggest that they don't really feel at home in either party. And it makes sense. They have a combination of values that don't really sit very well with either current party.
Both of these categories describe young voters. One maybe leans a little bit left, the other a little bit right. But do you think we can infer anything from these typologies about the future of our country's political makeup and where we're headed?
Well, I certainly think that one of the things that we can look at is that young people in general tend to be socially liberal. And it may not be that they're consistently liberal when it comes to other sets of values, but when it comes to issues, you know, particularly the issue of gay marriage, young people have kind of moved very steadily in the direction of favoring gay marriage. And so and we've seen a shift overall in the public on that, but it's been sharpest among the youngest. But there are still a fair number of young people who are skeptical of government. And so I think one of the questions we have is sort of where the Republican Party, where the conservative movement goes when it comes to the younger generations, and whether they grab on to some of these young outsiders on some of the issues that those groups don't feel quite at home with. I think the next generation left is a little bit more straightforward. In a lot of ways, they do have quite a lot in common with the solid liberals. And so it may be that where they diverge is actually interestingly on issues, some issues about racial and ethnic policy. So solid liberals, the slightly older liberal wing of the public, is the group that's most likely to see racial discrimination as a problem in society. Whereas, you know, one could argue that the next generation left perhaps has sort of sees those sorts of things as the public policy issues of the past, of their parents' generation. And maybe they have a new way of thinking about issues of race and ethnicity.
Is there anything that we can infer from this study that will tell us anything about how voters will vote in November in the 2014 elections?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that we have seen time and time again, as do many others, is that the dynamics of a presidential year and a midterm year are very, very different. And I think we see it here in that, you know, consistently those conservative groups, the steadfast conservatives and the business conservatives, voted for Romney in 2012 and will vote Republican in 2014. And liberals voted overwhelmingly for Obama in 2012 and overwhelmingly prefer Democrats in 2014. And we see to varying degrees support among the middle groups for Democrats today over Republic. I mean, some of the middle groups. So the next generation left, for instance, favor Democrats 61-27 today. But they actually favor Democrats to a lesser extent than they favored Obama in 2012. So one thing that we see is that, you know, the dynamics of a midterm election favor Republicans a little bit more than the dynamics of the 2012 presidential race. And the other thing to keep in mind is that those middle groups, those ones that are more up for grabs, are also the least likely to turn out and vote in a midterm election. And so, you know, what really, really matters is bringing out those steadfast conservatives and business conservatives and the on the right and solid liberals on the left, because it's very, very hard to engage some of those middle voters in midterm elections.
So I hate to ask you to play campaign strategist, but my next question was, do you think the election results come down to participation within those middle groups? Particularly, I'm interested in the hard-pressed skeptics, a group that you all describe as financially stressed and pessimistic. But I think you just answered that question. It's more about inciting the base than it is really reaching out to those in the middle.
Well, that group in particular, it's true of some of the other middle groups, but that group in particular is in a lot of ways just not excited about politics. But we can also see, so it's hard for either side to motivate them. That group is a group that in 2012 voted for Obama by a clear margin, 65-25, but in 2014 favors Democrats by a much narrower margin. So one thing about that group is if you're a Democratic strategist trying to engage them, it's a lot harder to get them on your side. But they are also the least likely or among the least likely of all of the groups in our typology to turn out and vote. So it's very hard to get them to get them to turn out.
Jocelyn Kiley is the Associate Director of Research with the Pew Research Center. You can find out more about the political typology quiz, including a link to their website to take that quiz, on our website, wvpublic.org. Jocelyn, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
We continue our look at third-party candidates this morning by staying in the 2nd Congressional District. Last week, we heard from Independent Ed Rabel, a Charleston-area native and former network television reporter. Today, we turn to Davy Jones, a libertarian and former IT worker for the party. Jones is also a political newcomer, running against Rabel, Democrat Nick Casey, and Republican Alex Mooney for the House seat Shelley Moore Capito will vacate in the fall. Liz McCormick has this profile.
Davy Jones lives in Martinsburg and is a political newcomer. He found his way into politics after doing IT work for the West Virginia Libertarian Party. But he didn't always identify as libertarian.
I was a Reagan Republican, and I kind of felt over the years after Reagan was out of office that the Republican Party has veered away from its base.
Jones says he has a live and let live mentality, which led him to join the Libertarian Party.
I believe the government has gotten way too intrusive into everybody's life and gotten way too bloated. And the debt that they seem to be heaping on our children that have to pay it is just outlandish. So I've decided that I needed to do something about that, and that's why I decided to run.
Jones knows it may be difficult to run on a third-party ticket, but he thinks he's got a great chance.
I think people are tired of just what's going on, and I don't think parties matter to them at this point. I think they're really looking for a candidate of character rather than a candidate of this party or that party. And I bring that to this race.
Jones says he's pro-coal. Both his grandfathers were coal miners, and he's outraged by proposed EPA regulations that would require coal-fired power plants to cut carbon emissions by up to 30% by 2030. He says the rules would kill West Virginia coal jobs.
I don't know if everyone knows that it was a Republican president, Richard Nixon, through an executive order that brought us the EPA and has allowed this regulatory agency to enact the regulations they currently are enacting, and allowed future presidents to abuse those regulations like President Obama is doing currently. And these agencies have pretty much bypassed Congress. And I would actually like to get rid of these agencies that have no oversight from the people.
But his live and let live philosophy extends to more than just regulations for businesses. He says that stance holds true for him on social issues as well, including gay marriage.
I believe that in this country, you're free people, so you should be free to love. And that means whoever you want to love. Interesting enough, my wife is an African American, and just less than 50 years ago, it would have been illegal for me and her to have gotten married.
The couple now has two young daughters. Jones also thinks he's the best choice because he can identify with the middle class.
I think that the big problem in politics today is that we're electing people to represent us that can't relate, that are wealthy, that come from an elitist group of people, and they can't represent the average American because they can't understand how we live. I come from the middle class. I know what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck, you know, deciding whether am I going to pay my electric bill this paycheck or buy food. So I think that I make a very good representative for the people of West Virginia.
Davy Jones is banking on his pro-guns, pro-energy, and pro-constitution platform to override the difficulties of running as a third-party candidate. He hopes the voters will give him a chance in Washington when they go to the polls in November. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown.
You're listening to Viewpoint on West Virginia Public Radio. I'm Ashton Mara.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by AARP, providing real possibilities to its nearly 300,000 members in West Virginia. On Facebook at AARP West Virginia or online at aarp.org/WV.
Every week, we'll check in on the latest news from the campaign trail with reporters from across the state covering the races at every step along the way. This week, we're joined by David Gutman, reporter for the Charleston Gazette. Dave, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Pam Pritt with the Beckley Register Herald. Pam, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Ashton.
Let's start with the latest big name to visit Washington this campaign season. Karl Rove, President George W. Bush's former deputy chief of staff, made a stop in Huntington earlier this week with Evan Jenkins. I believe that event was closed to the media, but obviously anytime any of these big names come to town, the opposing party finds some way to speak out against it. Dave, what did the Democrats do this week?
Well, the fundraiser in Huntington was actually at the same time as an interim meeting of the veterans committees, which Jenkins sits on. So the Democrats pointed out that he was indeed missing a interim meeting on veterans affairs for this fundraiser with Karl Rove, to which the Jenkins campaign said he was listening in remotely. But, you know, they did a little protesting. And the Associated Press story on the Rove event actually pointed out kind of the absurdity of our campaign finance laws, that Karl Rove runs this organization called Crossroads GPS, which legally cannot coordinate with a campaign in any way, but Karl Rove himself can come and fundraise.
Mm-hmm. So this congressional district is your coverage area in Southern West Virginia, Pam, and this one is getting kind of ugly, especially when it comes to advertising on television.
The advertising is just incredibly ugly. In fact, I'm beginning to think that West Virginia voters might want to hear more about what these candidates will do than how much they hate each other.
Mm-hmm. And Ray Hall made a statement yesterday that Evan Jenkins wasn't supporting his negative. He wasn't stopping his negative advertising on Patriot Day, and he didn't like that very much.
That's correct. The congressman pointed that out and said he'd suspended all his negative campaign advertising for the anniversary of 9/11, an event which brought the country together. And Jenkins continued with his. And so Ray Hall did break the silence to point that out to everyone.
Yeah, so it's not even taking a break for 9/11 to stop criticizing the other. So, Dave, your coverage area is here in Charleston in the 2nd Congressional District. What kind of messages are Mooney and Casey sending through their advertisements?
Well, up until this week, they'd both that race has certainly been a little more low key so far than the 3rd district race, which has seen, you know, as Pam said, millions and millions of not only spending by both campaigns but by outside groups. In the 2nd district, it's been a little more low key. Both campaigns had run ads, but they were just kind of generic. You know, I'm Alex Mooney. I'm running for Congress. This is what I'll do. Or I'm Nick Casey. I'm running. I'm a fiscal conservative. Things like that. Until this week, when both campaigns began running attack ads, which I think are really getting to the themes that we're going to see for the rest of the campaign, which is both campaigns are trying to paint this picture of which are voters going to like less. The Mooney campaign is painting Casey as, you know, a Democrat who once supported Obama, which is true, and the Casey campaign is painting Mooney as a political opportunist who you know, is not from Maryland is not from West Virginia and moved here from Maryland about 18 months ago, pretty much explicitly to run for Congress. In fact, I just earlier this morning got a press release from the Casey campaign. They're dubbing this weekend's football game between West Virginia and Maryland the Casey Mooney Bowl.
I hadn't seen that one. So on the Senate front, the Natalie Tenage, Shelley Moore Capito campaign, you wrote an article earlier this week about their new focus on healthcare in advertising.
Yeah, I think both campaigns are now currently running ads about healthcare. And I think what we're trying to see, or what we're seeing, is both campaigns grappling a little bit with a healthcare law that is still largely unpopular and certainly was passed by a president who is very unpopular here, but is also, you know, no matter what you think of it, is bringing some undeniable good things to West Virginia. 145,000 people have Medicaid because of the healthcare law in West Virginia. And we see both campaigns this week running ads about the provision in the healthcare law, which says you can no longer discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. So the Capito campaign is running an ad where the congresswoman talks about how Obamacare is taking away our freedom and, you know, taking away our way of life, while at the same time a narrator says that Congresswoman Capito supports a ban on discriminating against pre-existing conditions, which may well be true, but the only reason that ban exists is because of this law. And Natalie Tennant's campaign is running an ad also saying, you know, she will never let us go back to where you can discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions, while at the same time in the ad she's saying, you know, there's a lot wrong with this law, there's a lot I'd like to fix. And she's also, you know, says she doesn't want to repeal the law, which Congresswoman Capito does, but she is reluctant to say whether or not she would vote for the law if she had been in the Senate.
You know, beyond just what the candidates say in that article, I thought Perry Bryant with the West Virginians for Affordable Healthcare made an interesting point. He's saying both candidates are against the individual mandate, but they would both keep the mandatory coverage for pre-existing conditions. And Brian is basically saying you can't have it both ways.
It's true, you can't have it both ways. I guess I would. Capito is certainly against the individual mandate. Tennant has said she would like to delay the individual mandate. She hasn't really said until when, so I guess there's a little more gray area there. But no, what Perry Bryant said and what most health analysts have said is that you need the mandate. Without the mandate, you could just have, you know, healthy people could just wait until they get sick to sign up. And then, you know, you break your leg or, God forbid, you get cancer or something. You sign up for health care, you get better, and then you drop your insurance. Mm-hmm. And it just is not a workable system. And what he said is, you know, there is no credible, politically feasible alternative out there right now that does not include an individual mandate.
So I want to move on to endorsements. Last week, we mentioned that Tenet took the endorsement from the United Mine Workers. This week, the National Rifle Association announces their endorsement of Capito. Pam, any surprise with the NRA's pick?
Not at all. I think the NRA is probably always going to support the Republican candidates. It's surprising to me, I guess a little bit more that Tenet picked up the endorsement from the United Mine Workers, even though Democrats generally get union endorsements. The way the state has gone politically and becoming more conservative, that did surprise me.
Mm-hmm. You think that maybe the mine workers, you thought that maybe they would lean toward Capito?
I did think so because of social issues more than their own jobs. In West Virginia, we seem to be okay with voting against our own self-interest.
So I think the NRA is probably not that surprising, especially if you all seen this Twitter advertisement with Capito holding a shotgun, asking people to join her fight to protect the Second Amendment. I think that one's kind of interesting. It's showing up for me a lot. But I want to go back to something that Ken Rudin said in the interview this morning at the top of the show. He says these endorsements by big names, by unions, by associations, by Karl Rove, Mitt Romney, he says those don't matter and they don't sway the opinion. And I'm interested in what you all think of that. Dave, let's start with you.
You know, I would tend to cede towards his expert opinion. I think, you know, it probably depends. I think an endorsement from somebody like Karl Rove, who frankly isn't that popular, but certainly can bring in fundraising dollars, probably doesn't matter at all. But the endorsement of, you know, I think the, you know, traditionally, certainly maybe less so now, but you know, unions tend to vote in blocks. And so I think the endorsement of a union does still matter. I think the endorsement of the NRA, you know, it's one of the most politically powerful, politically successful organizations in the country. And so I would say, yeah, yes, it probably matters. I don't think there's necessarily a whole lot of difference between the two candidates on gun rights. But I do think it, you know, it matters some. Mm-hmm. Probably not a huge deal, as Ken said.
Mm-hmm. Pam, we have about 30 seconds. Do those endorsements matter?
I think Dave's right. I think the endorsements matter for things like the NRA. People are frightened that their gun rights are going to be taken away. As long as candidates continue to play into scare tactics like that, I think those kinds of endorsements will always matter.
Pam Pritt with the Beckley Register Herald, David Gutman with the Charleston Gazette, thank you both for joining me today.
Thank
you. You're welcome.
Viewpoint is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia political news by following our show on Twitter at ViewpointWV or on our website, wvpublic.org. Our theme song was written by Matt Jackford. Our producer is Beth Voorhees. Our director is Bob Powell. I'm producer and host, Ashton Mara. Special thanks today to Liz McCormick. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next Friday, Viewpoint, on West Virginia Public Radio.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by AARP, providing real possibilities to its nearly 300,000 members in West Virginia. On Facebook at AARP West Virginia or online at aarp.org/WV.